Okay, I think we're in business now. All right, so today we discuss the Sedra Vayetze. By way of introduction, the pasuk at the end of Micha, the very last pasuk, we say a few times a year in the Haftarah, Titein emes liYaakov, chesed Avraham, asher nishbata lavaseni mimekedem. We just read it a few weeks ago. And read this also Mincha Yom HaKippurim, these pesukim beginning Mikel Kamocha are appended to Maftar Yonah. Titen emes liYaakov, God should grant truth to Yaakov, meaning the descendants of Yaakov. Chesed Avraham, kindness to Avram, asher nishbata lavaseni mimekedem, as was promised to our fathers from days of old, that God should fulfill the promises of truth laid out to Yaakov, etc. But Yaakov is therefore associated with the Midah of Emes, the Midah of truth. And that's the paradox, because in Vayetze is filled with deception from beginning to end. In fact, the whole Sedra revolves around various types of deceptions that took place. For Yaakov, who is introduced to us as Ishtom Yoshev Ohalim, as a simple person, but Tam meaning Tamimus, complete, whole, perfected. So Yaakov really enters a new world now. First, we all know, Lavan deceives him regarding his daughters. Lavan promises Yaakov, and in fact it's spelled out quite specifically, he'll work 7 years. Evadcho sheva shanim birachel bitcha ktano. Yaakov says to Lavan, Sparchav tes pasuk yud ches, I'll work 7 years for you, for Rachel, your younger daughter. And Lavan agrees. And then, as we know, the night of the wedding, he substitutes Leah for Rachel. And as we discussed, I think, last year, they acquiesce. They go along. At the end of the day, Yaakov is deceived. So you have not only Lavan deceiving him, but his very own wives deceived him. Then, as the Sedra continues, after most of his children are born, so the Torah relates to us the great wealth of Yaakov Avinu that he gets. It's Perek Lamed Pasuk Mem Gimel. But the man Yaakov expanded his holdings. He was a very wealthy person. This wealth having little to do with Lavan, because as the Torah says, the whole story that's related here, that Yaakov and Lavan entered into a salary arrangement. Yaakov would work for Lavan in exchange for which he would get a certain percentage of the flock of a certain type, whether it was speckled or spotted or brown, whatever. And in fact, what Lavan did, as the Torah says, is Pasuk Lamed Hei, Vayasar Bayomahu Asat Yashim Hakudim Atulim. So if Lavan promised Yaakov he would be paid whatever speckled or spotted sheep were born, so Lavan then took speckled and spotted sheep out of the flock, ostensibly solid colored sheep would not produce speckled offspring, so Yaakov couldn't get paid. So Yaakov, as the Torah says, devised a system with rods and sticks, etc., whereby he was able to produce that even these solid sheep produced speckled and spotted offspring. And when that happened, Lavan changed it. And he said, I meant that you should get solid. So Yaakov had to switch it back and forth, so much so that at the end of the Sedra, their great confrontation, Yaakov says to Lavan, that you change vatachalefes maskurti aseres monim. You change my wages 10 times. I mean, each time you say we get something, and that's what was produced, you said, no, I meant the other thing. Go back and forth. So Lavan couldn't be pinned down. And that really is the entire Sedra. what's interesting is that if you look for a moment at Perek Chav Tes, Pasuk Yud Bez, when Yaakov first meets Rachel, and he's told who she was, and he's overcome that this is the first person he should see, his niece. Vayaged Yaakov l'Rachel ki achi aviyahu. Yaakov related to Rachel that he is her father's brother, v'chi ven Rivkahu, and he's also Rivka's son. Vataratz v'tagei l'aviyah. She ran and told her father. So of course, what's the difference between achi aviha and ben Rivka? It's the same thing. I'm your mother's brother, so I'm my mother's son. It's the exact same thing. I'm sorry, your father, rather, is my mother's brother, and I'm her son, but it's really the same relation. So Rashi explains, Rashi's in Pasuk Yud Bez, Midrasho, why did he say, Achi Avihahu? I'm really the brother of your father, meaning he's a nephew. Imli Ramos Huba, Gamani Achiv Veramos. If he's come to trick me, to deceive me, so you should know I'm his brother in deceit. Mm-hmm. I could fool him like he could fool me. V'madam kosheru, but if he's honorable, then gamani ben Rivka, achaso akshera, I'm the son of Rivka. So Yaakov was sending a dual message, that if Lavan wants to cheat him, so he's aware of it, and he'll know how to cheat back. Whereas if he wants to deal with him above board, honestly, then I'm Ben Rivka, Rivka Kshera. Of course, the question is, who's he kidding? The fact is, Lavan had his way with Yaakov time and again, starting from the very beginning. So if Achiv Hu Biramos, in fact, it's not so. We see, unfortunately, that Yaakov lost a number of rounds with Lavan. And then at the end had to escape with his life. So who is he kidding? How is he Achiv Ramos? What's even more fascinating is Yaakov's metamorphosis, because he, the Ishtam, is now in effect boasting that Achiv Ani Biramos, I could be as deceitful as he is. Where does that come from? Last week, after the Shir, and by coincidence, this past Shabbos, after davening, one of the younger people in the shul, young, I mean 5-6 years old, child, asked me, how was Yaakov able to lie to his father? The brachas we discussed last week. Someone asked it right. How was he able to lie? So let's use that as our starting point. In last week's address, so Rivka imposes upon Yaakov the obligation to go to his father and essentially fool Yitzchak into giving the brachos to Yaakov. So we discussed what the brachos meant and etc. And Yaakov, of course, was a very reluctant participant. So much so, he raised all sorts of obstacles to his mother. It's Perek Chav Zayin Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayomer Yaakov el Rivka Imo. He said to his mother, Heine Esav Achi Ish Sair Vanachi Ish Chalak. Esav is a hairy person. I am smooth-skinned. Ulai yimusheni avi. Maybe my father will feel me to see who's he in front of him. They sounded the same. Ve'yisi ve'inav kimisateya. He'll look at me as a liar, as a mocker. Ve'yisi olai klolo v'lo v'racha. And he'll curse me rather than bless me. So his mother said, no, you have to go. Now what happens? A few psukim later, pasuk yitches. Vayavol aviv, vayomer aviv, vayomer hineni, mi ata bni. All right, comes to his father, it's his father, and his father says, who is it? It's hineni, it's me. And Yitzchak says, mi ata bni. Vayomer Yaakov el aviv. Yaakov says to his father, anochi Esav b'charecha. I am Esav, your firstborn. Asisi kasher dibarto eloi. I've done exactly what you told me, and then it unfolds. So it doesn't seem like he told the truth. And it wasn't enough for Yaakov. It's one thing to do passively, to wear someone else's garb in order to deceive someone. But now he seems to be saying verbally, explicitly, something which is untrue. So Rashi redefines it. Rashi says
when Yaakov said, Anochi Esav Bichorecha, all the Torah gives us is the words. We don't know the inflection. We don't know how it's said. So Rashi supplements it, quoting the Medrash. Apparently he said it with a pause. Anochi Hu Hamevi Lecha. I am here. I'm the one who's giving you the food. In the words of the Medrash, Anochi, I'm the one whose children will receive the Aseres HaDibros, beginning Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Anochi, but Esav hu b'charecha. Esav is your b'char. It's very nice. I don't know if it'll stand up in court necessarily. You know, you could say something, if you say something which whose truth is in a context so limited that only one person understands it, most people would interpret that as a falsehood. So what exactly is Yaakov saying? What is he doing? I mean, why even put it in such a way? Maybe the better question is, why does Rashi go, look, you say, you have to lie, fine. Sometimes you have to lie, we'll see. So, but why does Rashi go to such lengths to take words which seem to us to be untrue and try to fit them into an unusual context in which they are made to be true? Why is that? Well, obviously, as we discussed last week, someone said, was there another way to do it? Could they have spoken, etc.? So in fact, last week we discussed that there was no other way, that Yaakov had to deceive his father, and Rivka had to be the one to orchestrate that deception, because in fact, Yitzchak could not accept that there was no role in the Beis Avraham, no primary role for Esav the son, and Rivka had to show him that it was easy to be deceived through externals, which in fact was the test. That just like Esav had deceived Yitzchak through externals, really questions that he asked, or superficial conduct that looked positive, so too Yaakov could also deceive Yitzchak. So when Yitzchak saw how possible superficial deception was and how complete, so therefore he was shocked into an awareness of how he had misapprehended the situation, and therefore Rivka was correct. It's a simple pshat. How could Yaakov do what he did? It's a terrible conflict. In fact, the question the little boy said to me is, how could he lie to his father? So I said, well, the problem was his mother told him to do it. So you see, it's a problem. If your father tells you to do one thing, and your mother tells you to do something else, or your mother tells you to do something, what do you see before? What do you listen to? So that was Yaakov's dilemma. I mean, no child should be put into that dilemma. But apparently Yaakov realized it wasn't just a simple instance here of a deception, that there was much more at stake. All of which gives rise to the reality that what Rashi's telling us is that Yaakov had to be deceitful here. He had to be deceptive. But even Yaakov, the Ishtom, had to put his deception in a certain context, that there was a system. That if there was a way to do it whereby he wouldn't have to lie outright to minimize the lie, so that's what he endeavored to do. And that's Emes LeYaakov, and that's Rashi's Pshat. Anochi Esav Bichorecha. That in fact, I am who I am. We weren't there to hear it. He said it with a pause. But Esav Bichorecha. Esav really is your firstborn, but it has to take place in other way. Yet, so again, it's a very nice Pshat. And Yaakov is endeavoring as much as he can to avoid the disrespect of an overt, outright lie. But yet he did tell an untruth. So how is that possible? Why should the transmission of the brachos from Yitzchak depend on that type of deception? So the answer is something that we discussed, I think, a few years ago, that I've discussed in other contexts as well. Something that's important to know. Of course, truth is a value. MS is very important. But truth is not an absolute value, as we well know. Truth is a relative value. And sometimes absolute truth is no value at all. All right? I don't think anybody here would ever want to hear the absolute truth, how people feel about them. There's a certain constructive hypocrisy that we live with. But not only do we recognize that on the psychological level, intuitively, but we recognize that practically also. And certainly the halacha takes note of those things. MS, truth, is not necessarily a factual reality. That's not MS. MS really is a perception.
What?
Perception of reality, especially the reality of the Ratzon Hashem. All right, so we all know their contexts in which we lie. Certainly, the contexts which Chazal recognize are those which are going to engender an ethical sensitivity that otherwise would be lost. Sometimes, and that's to achieve other goals. I mentioned to someone the other day, the famous case in Aloha. Say you have a person who's a parent, all right? The parent is suffering from lung cancer, emphysema, something terrible, because they're heavy smokers, and they cannot break the habit. And the patient, father, asks the son, could you get me a cigarette? The son is allowed to lie and say, we're out of cigarettes. He's allowed to lie. So you'll say, oh, he's lying to his father? Yes, but in that case, the lie itself serves a more noble goal. The greatest reality, Chosamo Shel Kadosh Baruch Hu Emes, God's seal is truth, the Gemara says. So the greatest reality we have is the existence of God. And that which furthers God's will is Emes. That's defined as Emes. Chosamo Shel Kadosh Baruch Hu Emes. That's the factual reality. The factual reality is not as significant, not as imperative, as that which will further God's will. That's not the same as saying that whatever person thinks is going to further God's will, she's allowed to lie and cheat and steal. It's completely false. But absolute MS is always going to defer to the Ratzon Hashem. Almost all the cases we have in halacha are those which, as I mentioned, are going to, bless you, going to further some ethical sensitivity. Classic case, peace, shalom. A person is allowed to lie for the sake of peace. You have two cases in Gracious, one in Vayera, where God himself, so to speak, deviated from the truth so as not to hurt Avram's feelings. And Yosef as well told his brothers that our father told me, don't take any vengeance upon them, when in fact it did not happen. So the brothers said that. The brothers said that. So Chazal derived. You could be Mishana for the sake of peace. You can deviate from the absolute truth. Well, the Gemara B'Metzia is a few cases, three cases. Maseches Puria and Ushpizo. That if a person is asked, has he learned such and such, he's allowed to say, no, he hasn't. For the sake of humility, he shouldn't be boastful. Or if a person is asked something about an area of tznius, a private marital life, he's allowed also to lie so people shouldn't know. Or Ushpizo, that if someone is asked, is such and so, so and so a good host? So the person is allowed to say, yeah, you know, he doesn't have to give the full truth, so no one should come and take advantage of that person. In all three cases, MS gives way to a greater ethical objective. Now, you see, it is justified, and in fact, that's what happened here. Because Yaakov Avinu saw that the absolute truth would be destructive. Even though he was uncomfortable with the methodology, nevertheless he realized that it was necessary. And therefore, he listened to his mother, and he did what he did. And again, like Chazal say, he did it in a way so as to minimize the offense, verbalizing his untruth with as little demonstrative, overt falsehoods as necessary. What he did do, though, is allow his father to draw false conclusions. All right? So on a technical level, granted, he was obligated by his mother to do it. We recognize he's uncomfortable. He's a shtam. It goes against his nature. It's not the type of thing that he wants to do. But he did it. And now we come to Vayetze. And what happens in Vayetze? So even though it was justified, and even though he had to do it, and even though his mother told him, so there are consequences also. There is an effect. And the effect of entering, putting one's feet in that cold water of deception, has an effect on the Ishtam. However you look at it, he's no longer pristine. He's no longer unsullied. Now he's part of that world. The world where truth cannot always coexist with shalom. And therefore, you have to at times deviate, prevaricate. So now that he is no longer unsullied, so therefore he recognizes, he gets a very nice introduction to the house of Lavan. Lavan ha'arami, that word arami recurs in the Sedra a number of times. In fact, it's arami is not only Aramean, but it means the deceiver. Yaakov will say to his father-in-law, V'lama rimi soni, why did you cheat me? Why did you trick me? So in fact, Yaakov now enters into a world where he's comfortable in saying to Rachel that I'm achi avia, achiv ani beramos, I can cheat him too. Yaakov's no longer ishtam, but you see, he may say it, but he doesn't yet have the worldliness, the experience. It gets easy, but he doesn't have the experience to really see through and deal on a on an open level with Lavan's deceptions. Because a person who's an Ishtam, who's a Yoshev Olim, always ascribes good motivations to others, as if they partake of the same value system that he has. But it has an effect. What's the effect? So you see, he tries. So when he comes to his father-in-law and he makes the deal for Rachel, so as Chazal say, he spells out exactly what he's looking for. I'll work 7 years for Rachel Bitcha Ktana. Why? As the Medrash says. Begin the Ana Yodad Anshe Mekomach Ramon. He says to Rachel that I know you're townspeople, they're a bunch of liars. Lefichach ani mavareri skimach. Therefore, I'm going to set everything on the table. So he says, Evadcha b'Rachel not Leah. Bitcha, so shalotovi acheres min ashuk, ushma Rachel. It's not just Rachel, so you shouldn't bring someone else, a girl from the marketplace, whose name is also Rachel. So it's b'Rachel bitcha. So b'Rachel bitcha, how many daughters does he love and have named Rachel, the younger daughters that are Tana? So why the daughter's named Rachel, that he should have to add the adjective, the qualifier, Aktana? So Yaakov knew well, Shel Tachalit Shimoson Zo Bezo, you shouldn't switch their names. All right. So Lavan is intent on giving away Leah. So he said, B'Rachel Bitcha. So I'll just rename Leah Rachel and rename Rachel Leah. So he said, no, Ktana, the younger daughter. Nevertheless, the Medrash continues, Afilu at no senes harasho b'chamor shel urcha rashim ein atmo memenu klum. You could lock a rasha in a wooden box, meaning you could try to cover every eventuality, every possible argument, but a rasha finds his way out. And that's exactly what Lavan did here. More than that, when Lavan decides to deceive Yaakov, so I said that Yaakov's deception in Toldos has an effect. What's the effect? So you see it here. So, as we discussed last year, Rachel and Leah, Yaakov rather, gave Rachel simonim, signs, a code that he should know that Rachel is really Rachel, because even then he didn't trust his father-in-law. So Yaakov gives these signs to Rachel. Rachel shares them with Leah. Defeats the whole plan. So the Medrash says, V'chol ha'hu le'elyo havatzavach le'Rachel. The whole night he's trying to verify her identity. He's crying out, Rachel, Rachel. And she's answering him, yeah, Rachel, right, whatever the simonim were, whatever the password was, she answered. It was Leah. Bitzafra, vihina hi Leah, the Torah says. Wake up in the morning, it's the wrong woman. Amar lo, so Yaakov said to Leah, ma ramaisa basrama, you're a deceiver, the daughter of a deceiver. Lav belelya hava korena Rachel, vat anisle. The whole night I'm calling out, Rachel, and you're answering me. You're not Rachel, you're deceiving me. Amar alei, so she said to Yaakov, Is safar delesle talmidim? Is there a barber that doesn't have disciples? Meaning that even a barber, he could teach hair cutting. But someone has to cut his hair. Can't cut his own hair. Lo kachoyet tzavach loch avuch Esav, vat anochle? Wasn't your father crying out to you, Are you Esav? Are you Esav? And you answered him too? So he did the same thing. Mido keneged mido. You deceived your father. The same way you deceived your father, you were deceived. More, vayomer el Lavan, mazos asisoli. Yaakov cries out to Lavan, Why did you deceive me? Why did you trick me? Here we had this whole arrangement, right? Halo v'Rachel avanti mach. I work for Rachel. V'lamarimi sani. Why did you trick me? So what does Lavan answer? Lavan says, Vayomer Lavan, Pasuk Havav, Lo ye'asechein bimkomeinu, Lo seis hatzi'ira lefnei habachira. We don't do such things in our town, to give away the younger daughter before the older daughter. Where does this policy come from? So Chazal say in the Medrash, is the point that Lavan was making to Yaakov, Lo ye'asechein bimkomeinu. In our place, we don't take the younger child before the older child, as opposed to, say, your place, where in fact you deceived your father, so he favored the younger son over the older son. So now who are you to complain about deception? You'll tell me that my deception came about from the holiest and most pure motives, and Lavan's deceptions were based on greed and trickery. Makes no difference. To the liar, to the cheat, to the rationalizer Lavan, he's always able to find some justification for his conduct. So even the superficial lie that Yaakov told, even within the limited constraints that Yaakov offered his deception to his father, it has an effect. An effect on Yaakov, an effect on the way people will treat him also. So he'll ask me, why should that be? What did he really do wrong? His mother said. But you see, the way of the Torah is all accounts are balanced. And you're allowed to lie for the sake of shalom. It's true. But in fact, there wasn't absolute shalom here. Because what Yaakov did brought his father pain, and it brought his brother pain. Maybe his brother deserved the pain. But nevertheless, Chazal say, we suffer to this day for the Tzaaka Gedola Umara, the loud and bitter wail that Esav emitted, we still suffer because that was a sincere one. So you could be Mashana for the sake of shalom, but if it's not absolute shalom, meaning people are tormented by it, then there's a price to be paid. And the sensitivity of the Torah, the cheshbon that the Torah exacts, is very precise. And that's what Yaakov found here in his dealings with Lavan. So then the question becomes, why is that? What in fact happened to Yaakov? Why was it so terrible that Yaakov had to have this fate befall him? That his mother told him to do what he did, and we benefit from that to this day. But yet he's put into such a hostile environment, which really threatens his tamimus. Threatens his tamimus. He's not the same person at the end of Vayetzeh as he is the beginning of Vayetzeh. You see, even his dreams change. He's dreaming about the angels at the beginning, and he's dreaming about the sheep and goats at the end. So his whole personality changes. In fact, it's when Yaakov realizes the danger, the spiritual danger that he's in, after 20 years, that he says to his wives, it's time to leave. But why, what is the limit in this? In fact, the Torah seems to spend an inordinate amount of time on Yaakov's stay in Lavan's house, which seemingly has a very defined end. At the end of Vayetzeh, really, we don't encounter Lavan anymore. That's it. The rest of the Torah is gone. Yaakov moves on. And yet, Vayetzeh is a very long sedra. And the whole Perek, Lamed Aleph, deals basically with Yaakov's life in Lavan's house. So, what is the limud? I think the answer is, it's a very, very important point
that reflects the great klal that Chazal say in Sefer Bereishis generally, of kol mashir l'avos simen l'banim. Ma'isavos simen l'banim. What happens to our fathers happens to the children as well. And the Torah is giving us an insight into the nature of our world, our history, what will befall the children of Yaakov. You see, Lavan really is a new type of Rasha, a Rasha that we never encountered before. So wicked, so nefarious, that in fact we say in the Haggadah, Arami Oved Avi, Vikesh Lavan, Lakar Esakol. Lavan wanted to destroy everything. Kill Yaakov, kill his own daughters, his grandchildren. What was so terrible at Lavan's rishus? Worse than Esau, worse than Nimrod. Why is why does he become the primary villain in the introduction, that introduction to Maggid? So the answer is that in all of Sefer Bereishis until now, we've really had one type of Rasha. That Rasha was primitive, a brute, someone who was just an unrestrained creature of the Nefesh HaBahami, the animalistic impulses of man. Whether it's the people of the generation of the flood, whether it's Nimrod, Sodom, Esau, that's a very familiar type of Russia to us. It's almost the cartoonish. If we would envision, you know, what those Rishoim are, so it's the person with a club who just goes and tries to kill and ravage and maraud, etc. Lavan is a new type of Russia. He's a sophisticated Russia. He doesn't use a club, a sword. Lavan uses his words. Lavan uses books. Lavan is a debater. He's argumentative. Lavan is very smooth, very urbane, but very unctuous. He's always rationalizing. He's always explaining himself away. A Lavan can say anything. He can do anything. He can speak out of both sides of his mouth. He won't ever admit that he's done anything wrong. A very, very difficult Rasha to confront. David HaMelech said in Tehillim, Tim Kufchav, that Mayitein lecha umayosef lach lashon rumiya, is what can I give to you? What can I say? How do I protect myself against the deceitful tongue? It's impossible. It's very difficult. I shouldn't say it's impossible. It's very, very difficult. Because whatever you say, there's an answer to. Look. Where are we today? So you have a whole chevra in Geneva. A new world is dawning upon us. All the problems in Israel are going to be solved tomorrow. Because once again, I could put everything in writing. And we had 10 agreements before. So what? This is it. How is it possible that you have supposedly sophisticated people, Jews especially, who will put their names to document after document, essentially promising what was promised before, just in exchange for new and greater concessions, and assume, even anticipate, that the new agreements will be adhered to when the prior ones were not? What does it come from? I think it comes from an inability to recognize what Lavan is like. What Lavan is like. What duplicitousness, what two-facedness is like. Just like it's hard for the Ishtam to sense any type of malice in someone else, and you project the best upon them, so too, I don't want to simplify because there are other reasons for it also, but so too it's very difficult to anticipate, to even to look back. I mean, you know, I was listening yesterday. Someone was saying, an Israeli was saying, as a matter of fact, you know, 3 years of war, it's been very, oh, I'll tell you, it was the Mayor of Yerushalayim. It was in the neighborhood yesterday. So I was invited to meet him, a small group, and he said, you know, 3 years of war, it's been very difficult in terms of life, in terms of the economy. So I'm thinking to myself, what is he talking about? There's 10 years of war. There were no suicide bombers before the year 2000. I mean, it started in 1994. At 10 years of war, you're talking 55 years of war, 120 years of war. So how is it possible for people who've lived through it
maybe that's the answer. They've lived through it. But how is it possible for people who've lived through it to just forget so simply? I mean, if you recall, Netanyahu was elected in 1996 because there was a wave of suicide bombings in Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim in March and April of that year. So how is it the people who are there, who've lived through it, who've suffered, how is it possible that their memories could be so short-lived that they, it just started 3 years ago, so maybe now, before 3 years, everything was fine, all right? Of course, only 500 people were killed before 3 years ago, in the 7 years before the year 2000, and now 900 have been killed, so it's far worse. But how is it possible to forget those who were killed? As if it didn't happen. As if somehow everything was blissful and peaceful, because you had, I think at that time, the reigning agreement was the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement. It's like 4 or 5 agreements ago, with the tenet understandings. It's so many agreements ago, but how is it possible to be so forgetful? And the answer is, that's Lashon Ramiya, a deceitful tongue, smooth talk. All you need is a small group of Arabs, even unrepresentative of any official body, saying, you know what? Shake my hand. Let me put my arm around you. Just leave. Give us what we want, and we'll all be eating hummus together in Ramallah next week. That's all it takes. And then, as Chazal say, Yaakov sees that, and Yaakov also wants to surrender, make concessions, forget. That's the power of deception. And that really is the strength and the danger of an enemy like Lavan. And in the Golos, we've had both such enemies. Esav, the Golos of Esav, Esav is an enemy. Esav is the one who attacks us with the sword up front. Lavan is the one who attacks us with the knife in the back. And we have both such enemies. Esav doesn't have to lull us to sleep. Esav is a frontal attack. Lavan, Arami. Lavan lulls us to sleep. And therefore it's very, very difficult to defeat a Lavan. What is Lavan plus Esav? The Nazis. The Nazis are very sophisticated brutes, Yimach Shmam. They could not only kill like Esav, but they could lie like Lavan. And at the heart of destruction, the mayhem they brought to our world was using the tools of Esav with the language of Lavan. And if I dare say, you know, it just struck me, it was a year and a half, 2 years ago, that I said for the first time publicly that the Arabs today, these are radical Muslims, they're really the Nazis. So now you see it, not only this context, that they have no compunctions about using the tools of Esav, but also they use the garb of Lavan too, a nice suit, and very polished in public, and they can't go so far. You know, they still can't really sit in a room with a Jew, but aside from that, to everyone else, like you see in the Times today, Assad, the president of Syria, a respectable person, he just wants what's his and leave us alone. The only problem that America has in the Middle East is because of the Jews, but aside from that, we have no issues with America, etc. Very, very debonair. He's a doctor, you know, Bashar Assad is an ophthalmologist, so he's educated, he's westernized. That's a big danger. I mentioned this because for the first time 2 weeks ago, I heard the same statement made by one of the American, not a military figure, but a political figure, who said that this war is like the Nazis again. It's not going to end easily, and you see is really, it's not the type of thing that you could just, you know, cut off the head and it goes away. But the Arab terror is going to be with us for a while, here, in America, in the Middle East, throughout the world. And the people have to steel themselves for a long haul. So in one sense, it was gratifying. I finally heard someone, non-Jew, a commentator, make this point that people should realize. But that's the threat. Very difficult. You see, the Nazis posed a tremendous... but for the Americans, of course, they would have conquered the old world, Europe and Asia. But that's a threat. To harness the might of Esav, really the guiltless tendency to massacre of an Esav, really without any regrets or compunctions, just horrific devastation. And to harness that with the diplomatic tools and the guile and the lying abilities of a Lavan,
That's a very, very formidable foe. And you see just in the statements that come out day after day, week after week from the Middle East, it's amazing that Ad Hayom, even today as we speak, today is Rosh Chodesh December, Ad Hayom, if you would stop a person on the street and say, with all Israel suffered the last 3 years, who's the victim, who's the aggressor? So you say, most of the world perceives Israel as the aggressor and the Arabs as the victims. That verbal leisure domain is a gift of Lavan. That's the legacy of Lavan, to be able to turn the tables. And you see, by the way, in our Sedra, in a very, very telling way. So what happens to Lavan in Yaakov's house? What happens to Lavan and Lavan when Yaakov is in his house? So Lavan recognizes, not only does Yaakov become wealthy, who becomes wealthy? Lavan becomes very wealthy. Who makes Lavan wealthy? Yaakov. So what happens as the story goes on? In Perek, Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, Vayishmas Devrei Lavan Lemor, all of a sudden Yaakov starts hearing Lavan's sons grumbling. Lokach Yaakov Eskol Asher Lovinu. Yaakov has just taken everything that belongs to our father. Yaakov is the one who's depleting our father. Our father's a wealthy man. Where does Yaakov get his money from? U'me'asher lo'avinu osois kol ha'kavod hazeh. From what belongs to our father, he has all this wealth. Meaning it's not that Yaakov produced the wealth for Lavan. It's rather, it's our money. He's wealthy. It's only because he's stealing from us. Where have we heard that before? That was a refrain in almost every society. It was Jews have lived in the exile. Jews came and basically revolutionized the economy of every nation. For good reason, by the way. I remember I spoke about this a few years when I was in Spain and Turkey. Jews really created the mercantile system in the world, in Spain and Turkey and even to the Orient, because of all the peoples in the world, Jews had no nationalistic ambitions. They were trusted by the powers that be, and they were Jews in different communities. So there were no language barriers, and there were always people to trust. So Jews became the couriers and the merchants and the middlemen of every society. So when you established products were made, say, in Spain, one in Turkey, the Orient, it was Jews who were the ones who were doing all the business, because this guy in Spain had a cousin who lived in Turkey, and he had the cousin living in Babel. That's how we became central to the economies of every nation in East and Western Europe and Asia as well. But in every society, it reached a certain point where the people said exactly this phrase. Look at the Jews. They're taking our wealth, squandering our money. They're doing the same thing. Same thing. In Germany, it happened also. The same thing happened in Germany. Lokach Yaakov Eskol Asher Lovinu. It's all ours. Why is he benefiting from it? U'me'asher lovinu asos kol ha'kavod hazeh. He only has it because he's stealing from us. That's it. And more, so Yaakov is the one who made Lavan rich. So what happens? Yaakov flees. Lavan chases him. So who's the one who's been cheated for 20 years? His wages changed 10 times. Cheated with his choice of wife, etc. It was Yaakov. Who claims to be the victim? Lavan. Lavan. Lama. Lavan chases after Yaakov, and he says to Meosiso, Vatignovus Livavi, you stole my heart. You think I'm the gun? You're the gun, not me. You're the cheater, not me. I'm the victim, not you. Yaakov finally explodes, but you see, he doesn't convince Lavan at all. Because this is a battle that you can't win. You cannot convince. You really cannot convince one of these. That's why some of these debates are... I'll only debate Jews. I once debated an Arab, and it's like talking to the wall. But Jews, something the same thing, but at least you have a similar language you can understand. An Arab, not. Their premises are just so different. And their conclusions can be so awry, and yet they can't be called to account for it. because their versions of history will just change. The facts will change based on the needs of the moment. So then what do you say to Yaakov? What would he say to the Bnei Yaakov? These are very formidable foes. Esav and Lavan together, Lavan itself. What do you say to such a threat? So that's what David HaMelech told us. There's only one way out, only one escape from such a threat. That's the beginning of the capital. Shilam Alos. What does it say? Anybody here know Tehillim by heart? All right. Hashem Hatzila Nafshi Misvasheker Miloshin Ramiya. Say, God, save me from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. The only salvation that comes in such a salvation from such a threat is from Hashgacha. That's it. God has to step in and bring the salvation himself. That's the only way. That really is the escape. And in fact, that's what happened here too. Because Lavan says to Yaakov, I would have killed you. But for the fact that your God appeared to me last night and said, Yishomer locha midaber Yaakov m'tov adro. Just be careful what you do with Yaakov. Don't say anything to him. So Lavan says, all right, God intervened. I'm not going to do anything. That really is the hatsala that we have in every... That really is the hatsala that we have in every generation. In every generation, to combat, in a sense, we can fight against an Esav. He's a much easier enemy. We could hide, we could run, we could flee, we could even defend ourselves. Against a loved one, it's very difficult, because his weapons are words and ideas, but words and ideas that have no common currency with that which we're used to. So it's very, very difficult to combat. That David HaMelech said the same thing. His enemies were also slinging lies at him, and threats, and deceit, claiming though to represent the truth, and integrity, and honesty, and God's will. Hashem Hatzila Nafshi Misvashekim Loshin Ramiya. That's it. You have to rely on the salvation of Hashem, and that really is the Maisev Asim Labanim. Here you have, you know, it's getting a little cozier. It's crunch time. Because all around us, the world is really closing in. It's amazing how these things happen. But just, you know, we should look at it from not just those experiencing it, but as observers too, how the world operates. I'm not talking in a mystical sense. I'm talking just in a realistic, practical sense, just looking at events. How everyone thinks, you know, a few years ago everything's solved, and this and that, and now you see Jew hatred arising everywhere in the world, and Israel again. It forgets what it went through. The people in the world forget or oblivious to what happened. And so the same cycle repeats itself, except the noose is a little tighter. And the avenues of escape are even more limited. And we come down to a situation, ultimately, when Klal Yisrael have only one place to turn. Alavinu Shebashamayim, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because there'll be no answers in the political realm, and no answers in the military realm, and no answers in the diplomatic realm, or in the financial realm. That's it. You can't buy our way out. You can't fight our way out. There's only one answer. To pray our way out. To be better Jews. To embrace the destiny of the Bnei Yaakov and the Bnei Yisrael. That really is our destiny. We embrace that destiny, then new vistas open up in the way we look at the world, and the way the Hashgacha responds to us. And then that's the moment of Yeshua. These events in Vayetze really are harbingers of much of our history. Vayetze, Vayishlach, our dealings with Lavan, our dealings with Esav. As we get closer to Yemos HaMashiach, we see just the past 100 years dealing with an Esav and a Lavan who are one person, wrapped together. The powers of both united in their viciousness, in their treachery. That's what we're facing today again. The hope is that the Bnei Yaakov have resource to what Yitzchak Avinu recognized, HaKol Kol Yaakov. When the Kol Yaakov is strong, then in fact the hands of Esav are weakened. When we strengthen the Kol Yaakov, then in fact our enemies will fall by the wayside, they'll feel the vulnerability, and ultimately they will come around and recognize not just the greatness of the Jewish people, but the godliness of the Malchus Hashem as well. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So again, when you're referring to Yaakov as MS, then it's just the MS.